Before we begin today's episode, I want to thank everyone who's taken this podcast journey with me since May of 2021. Since then, I've conducted 148 interviews, created 130 hours worth of content, and been lucky enough to have over 21,000 downloads. Today marks the 100th numbered episode of A Gamer Looks at 40, and I am thrilled to mark the occasion with a conversation with someone I consider to be a video game legend. A person who took a chance to make something different, and through that risk, created a magazine that helped define my childhood for nearly a decade. Thank you so much for listening, and enjoy the episode. When I received my Nintendo Entertainment System in the winter of 1987, my parents went slightly off script. Instead of the action set, which had a zapper and the Mario Duck Hunt combo cart, I received a basic set. Now, the basic set contained the system, two controllers, no packing game, and a copy of the official Nintendo Player's Guide. And somewhere in the depths of that box lived a tiny 4x6 registration card for the Nintendo Fun Club. Since it was free to join, my mom had no issue writing my name on that card and dropping it in the mail with our address. A few months later, I received a membership card, a welcome letter, and the first of several Nintendo Fun Club newsletters. Featuring tips, tricks, and previews to new games, this club cemented me as a Nintendo devotee. But when an oversized version of the newsletter with a claymation Mario on the cover landed in my mailbox in the summer of 1988, I knew I was in love. My Fun Club was now Nintendo power, and I had to have it. From that day forward, for the next 10 years, Nintendo Power served as my monthly connection to the world of video games. It wasn't just a place for codes and maps. It was a window to a world I could never even dream of tasting. Games I'd never play were burned into my memory via the pages of Nintendo Power. The magazine helped me become a better reader, inflamed my imagination, and allowed me to be conversant with my more affluent classmates who could actually afford the latest titles. And this week's guest was the architect for that formative subscription. On this episode of A Gamer Looks at 40, I chat with former editor-in-chief of Nintendo Power, among other accolades, Gail Tilden. During this conversation, we discuss how the magazine started, the philosophies behind the copy, and the unique culture of Nintendo that gave birth to this landmark publication. We have a fun one ahead, so let's run to the mailbox, rip the magazine from its plastic, and hope this month's contest is a good one as we embark upon episode 100, The Birth of Nintendo Power, with Gail Tilden. All right, Gail, well, thank you so much for taking time to chat with me about your time at Nintendo Power Magazine. Just so you know, Nintendo Power was extremely formative for me. I was one of those original 3.2 million people who got that issue for free in the mail because I was part of the Fun Club. So this is a real treat for me to talk to somebody who was actually able to be a part of that. So before we get started on that, I'd love to hear a bit of your life before Nintendo Power, how you came to be working over there at Nintendo, and just go from there.
Yeah, I was working in advertising and marketing, and I had a job at Britannia Sportswear. I live in Britannia, and I got in the advertising department there, and the person who hired me, her name was Deborah Simmons. And a couple years later, she called me and said, I'm having a baby. I'm at this company called Nintendo. It's the Donkey Kong company. And I really need, I'm having a baby like in a month. And I really would love it if you would come over here and help me out and make sure things are covered for my maternity leave. So thanks to Deborah, I joined the Donkey Kong company. And I have to say, I was a little... surprised in 1983 that I thought, oh, this is a Japanese company. It's going to be so high tech and, you know, advanced because they make like video games. And like, you know, we had a, for accounting, there was like an Apple IIe or something like that in a closet. And that was the most that, you know, of course, there was no such thing as like a PC on your desk or something. But
right.
It was way less high tech than I imagined, you know. It was Howard, Howard Phillips skateboarding around the warehouse. That's kind of the thing.
So in those early days, 83, that was before the launch of the NES in the US. So what were you doing for that beginning part? Were you kind of like ramping up for that? Because that was kind of like right when the game crash happened.
Yeah, you know, we had two different types of product lines. Of course, arcade games. And when I started, Donkey Kong 3 was my first game that I worked on.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, for that, we would go to these trade shows where there's two levels of people. There's a distributor, so people buy all the arcade games. And then they hire people called operators who go around to all the locations that they're placed on and open them up and collect the quarters. And it's a very funny business because it's really a vending business, like a Coke machine or a washing machine. And the idea that you are collecting cash out of something is also fraught with some type of underworld scenario.
Sure.
And so that it was a very funny business, very different levels of people from all over the country who were at the two different levels. So we were marketing to, right? We wanted people to purchase our big machines and put them in all these locations. And when you would go to trade shows and be marketing, you'd have, if a guy had a huge key ring filled with keys, he was an operator. He's someone who was collecting the quarters. If a guy was wearing a suit and looked like he was part of the mafia, he was definitely a distributor. So anyway, very funny. That was our first one of our lines of business. The other was Game & Watch and Tabletop Game & Watch.
Right.
The little mini arcade games and mini handheld games that were just an individual title. And so we would sell those at retail and did a little bit of TV advertising and that kind of thing. And we actually, I remember doing TV ads for something that, what was it called? They were silver, Spitball Sparky and something else. Anyway, they were a little bit more advanced because I think it had the screen had a little bit of color to it. And we used one of the scenes was a wedding scene. And so the staff all was the wedding guests in the TV commercial.
Oh, that's so fun. Oh, it's so fun. I love that.
Which was fun. So from there, we launched the NES in 85. And that
must have been a nerve-wracking experience launching the NES because, again, you had that crash. We had, you know, Atari wasn't doing well. Home video game systems, you know. Everyone listening to the show knows the story pretty much, but how much confidence did y'all have as a company when you launched at NES in America, at least?
So I think they didn't have that much confidence, but like we did many other times, really, you know, you go all at, we're all in, like big financial risk, big inventory risk. And so it was kind of an all-in proposition. At the time, keep in mind, I was like 27, advertising girl, and I wasn't privileged to many of those senior management decisions. I was working on the campaigns themselves and things like naming the products and getting the packaging all done, all those kinds of things with our advertising agency and PR firm, doing mall tours. But I was not a decision maker. Ron Judy was my boss. I want to give a shout out. He passed recently. And, you know, he's someone whose name doesn't come up. But Ron was actually the VP of sales and marketing that we all reported to. And then, of course, Mr. Arakawa was our president.
Were you responsible for a lot of the advertisements, TV advertisements?
Yes.
One of my favorites. The famous one, of course, is the Legend of Zelda one is, I think, probably one of the most famous of that time with the two kids the Zelda Rap. Was that, were you involved with any of those?
Okay, so Zelda Rap, although I think I was involved, the Zelda commercial that probably lost me my job as the head of advertising and marketing and got, brought someone in above me was Ron Judy left and a guy named Peter Main came in. Anyway, right at that time. So there is the Zelda commercial where he's in a padded cell.
Yes, I know this one. Yes, he's looking around for tech tights. Yeah, I know this one very well.
Yeah. Ooh, tech tights.
Watch Zelda become a legend on your Nintendo Entertainment System.
Zelda!
Which way to go? Good
time. Anyway, when that commercial was pitched to us, it was a stand-up comedian who was who was saying all these funny names and having a lot of physical comedy. And then I get to the set, and you know, in this kind of situation, like it's just me with the agency and the production company. And the actor, and then they do this padded cell thing. And I'm just like, this is not what you sold us. It was a huge issue. Everybody was upset. I was like, I cannot approve this. This isn't what you sold us. And I'm like, wow. Walking around Los Angeles, I've got art directors like begging me to do it. And I said, if we're going to do this, we got to call Nintendo. Of course, there's no video cameras or anything. We got to call Ron. We got to repitch this commercial because, you know, but anyway, even though we repitched it and we did it, I was the one there and I was the one responsible for the fact that it actually happened. And it gave way to the rap commercial quickly.
That's so interesting. But they aired it. They I guess they all spent the money on it, right? So it might as well go out. It's a very unique, I will say that. And it's very memorable. I remember that clear as day, that commercial. That's so funny. So moving from the Nintendo to doing advertising for NES to the magazine, were you also starting part of the Fun Club as well before that became Nintendo Power? Was that part of that transition?
Yeah. And, you know, something that just dawned on me recently, I kept thinking, like, why do people keep thinking that Howard Phillips somehow was in marketing or publications? Like, he had a very important job, but he wasn't, you know? And I thought, maybe people actually think being the president of the Fun Club News was actually a job. Like,
that's right.
They think that there was actually something that was an actual club somewhere and he was the head of it or something. I'm like, it had never struck me before that the idea that he was like the mascot somehow meant people thought that he actually really was responsible for that tool. And so it was very funny. But what happened was one of the marketing people that came in, we were focused on direct marketing and we were collecting all the names and addresses, partly for warranty or for other information.
Sure.
Which is how you got the 3.2 million people got the magazine. But what happened is that, so we hired an agency, I believe it was Footcomb Belding Direct, and they suggested that a marketing tool we could do is send out a newsletter, entice more people to send us their name and address by promising them this free newsletter. And so the creative aspect that they came up with was this idea that we'll use Howard, who we were using as a gamer spokesperson anyway. So he was the honorary president of the Fun Club, which was really the promised newsletter to get you to send us your name and address. But it grew. It was interesting, especially from Mr. Arakawa's point of view. It grew so fast, and we started making the newsletter more and more elaborate, which made it more expensive, of course, from the kind of black and pink one at the beginning to the Mike Tyson one at the end. It was very, the investment in knowing that so many people wanted more information was helpful. But I think Mr. Arakawa's exposure to how publishing is so popular in Japan and so popular for kids and teens that he said, my daughters were born in the U.S. Of course, they do speak and read Japanese, but they read those magazines. They can't wait, and they read them and consume them. And I know that it's not a cultural he said it's not a cultural difference. Somehow we don't have the right kind of publishing in the U.S. So then with the mission of helping make sure that people enjoyed their games and that they could get tips and help getting through them and that they would not feel that the parents wouldn't feel that they wasted their money. All this was predicated on the crash having happened. And also things like the game counselors were part of that philosophy, having strong customer service. I mean, our customer service agents had to come in on Christmas Day because if families opened their hardware and couldn't hook it to their TV, that would be a negative situation. So really the extra effort for making sure there would be high consumer satisfaction drove a lot of these decisions and tools. Plus, you know, when we got up to like 600,000 newsletters with by the time the Mike Tyson issue, to develop that and put it in the mail was definitely a drain on the traditional marketing budget.
So at that point, you decided to moved because you did bi-monthly originally, if I'm not mistaken. I think when Nintendo Power was a bi-monthly for maybe the first couple of years, and then you went to every month. And I think for a little while you were supplementing with strategy guides too. You were doing
right. So it was probably not 2 years before you received something in the mail monthly, but it was alternating, and then it ended up being an independent sale of the guide. Outside of the magazine. Plus, at the time, imagine that the licensing of third-party software started growing. In 1985, we didn't allow licensee titles. So as it started growing, because Nintendo Power started in 88, there was just a lot more to cover, a lot more information, a lot more to cover, a lot more to talk about. Game Boy came out, you know, which was kind of deadly for me, like covering Game Boy games was not fun. You're wearing a Tetris shirt.
I know. This was not intentional, I promise. This just happened to be what I put on this morning.
challenging game to cover.
Why was Tetris challenging? Was it because of the whole situation with Russia? Or what was this? Why was that a challenging one?
Oh, doing a review of tips and tricks, and you know, there's no maps, it's not colorful, it's not interesting. And Mr. Arakawa said you have to do 16. He didn't generally dictate what we needed to do in our coverage.
Sure.
But he said he wanted 16 pages on Tetris. And it was just mind-numbing that we do that.
I remember the Game Boy Tetris coverage. You had like the little cartoon Tetrinos or Tetras, whatever you call them. These little cartoon Tetras for some reason just came to my mind immediately.
Yeah, the Tetrads were Howard and Nestor.
Right. Oh, that's right. Yes. Oh my gosh, that's so good.
Yeah,
I can see that being challenging. There's really that. No maps. The strategy is complete lines, make Tetrises. Two pages.
I don't know.
Wow.
Challenging. Yeah.
Yeah. But that's a landmark game, obviously. And that's cool that you were a part of that. You did mention that a big part of your strategy was the help for the consumer experience. And that's very evident from the very beginning with your counselor's corner and classified information. Was there a large team at the beginning? I'm sure that team grew as the magazine grew. But I can imagine that being pretty challenging, culling that information and deciding what went where in that regard.
So the process was that for each issue, we would have a meeting and just like the editorial board, someone from marketing, I think, would sit in, me, we'd get Howard would be there, and senior writers would participate. And then we would look at, Howard was part of a group, but sometimes it was called the Big Three. Sometimes, you know, it varied, and that would rate the games on a 40-point scale. And in the magazine, there were some different iterations where we would use this thing that was a spider web and the spokes. Mm-hmm. How far out you were on each spoke was how positive it was, scale of 1 to 5. Right. So Howard's real job was game analysis and some localization. And so he was one of the people rating the games. So the way we would decide what game would be on the cover or what games we would heavily feature, how many pages a game would get, was based on the score, the scores from the big three. And then especially like if a game was coming out, it was kind of like, you know, it's going to be the cover and then are we going to do it in 2 months?
Right.
But usually it was only 2 months. And oftentimes a game in terms of interest from the consumer might be longer than 2 months, or not everybody buys it the very week it comes out. So what would happen is that we would need to rely on things like Counselor's Corner and Classified Information or a Player's Poll contest in order to give any more attention to that title. Because once you've given the strategy, there's not really an opportunity to do it. So then another thing that helped really give more attention to a very top-rated title was, of course, a strategy guide, a player's guide.
Do you know what's better than a freshly delivered copy of Nintendo Power direct to your mailbox with your name on it? My wonderful, sensational, and fabulous patrons, that's who. Starting with Terry Kinnair, Greg Seward of the Player One podcast and Generation 16 series of videos, the fantastic Games with Coffee, the Let's Play Princess, BT Goebbels, Tim Knowles, formerly of The Leadist, Julian of the Stage Select podcast, Seth Sergel of the All End podcast, and the wonderful, debonair, and always smashing Pete Harney. If you'd like to join these wonderful human beings, pop on over to patreon.com/agamerlooksat40, check out the tiers, and sign up today.
When I left Nintendo on leave to have my first child in 1988, I was in advertising.
Right.
But I was asked to come back to start up publishing. So when I came back, we interviewed two Japanese companies who had been successfully making these tips and tricks and maps and had developed a technique, because you would not be able to freeze frame to video and then freeze frame and put the maps together. So they had developed some techniques.
Okay.
So we chose Tokuma Shoten, and they had a design partner called Workhouse, and a company that prepared what's called the film. It's really when there's where there was no digital publishing, so this is all very hand done, called Dai Nippon. So the all the way through the proofs of the magazine was done in Japan. So usually two people would go in two shifts to Japan to review and proof everything. And then it was printed in California. And then even more complicated was that we, and especially Mr. Arakawa, didn't like the lack of security to be mailing all those, at the beginning, 3.2 million names out to the printer. So we started a mailing facility inside of Nintendo of America. So the so the magazines had to come, and any type of direct mail solicitation, like we actually had like at some point 10 million names. So any direct mail solicitation, our own in-house mailing facility did it in order to not leak our valuable customer base.
That's amazing, especially in those days. I mean, that's amazing you were that customer-minded. That's really admirable. And I think it comes through in the magazine, too, in the way it was written and presented and put together. I find that fascinating. What an undertaking. Wow. And your own mailing facility just to handle that, because you didn't want those names to get out there erroneously.
Right.
That's really something else.
So at our own office, we had, you know, we had the writers. We would make the editorial decision, and then we had the writers who would be making sure they knew their games thoroughly, and they would make sure that they would write the content to match the maps. But they also, you know, anything like Counselor's Corner, Classified Information, et cetera, our own writers wrote all those things, and we had to send them to be typeset in Japan. Sure. So the editorial side at the beginning was done at Nintendo of America, but all of the visual work was being done in Japan. And that was for a couple years. And then as a quote desktop publishing, or, you know, the digital publishing kept getting more and more advanced, it certainly changed over the years.
That's interesting. And as I'm thinking back to old issues, again, these old issues of Nintendo Power are permanently sealed into my brain. They're there. They're there. They live rent-free. It does have like a bit of a Japanese feel as far as artwork goes, as I'm kind of like just thinking through them. I'm going to actually go back and see if I can find those little like visual threads. That's very interesting that it was that kind of collaboration made for a very unique magazine and very memorable one for sure. When you were doing your reviews and deciding obviously what to include in the magazine, you had your scale. Did you ever have any pressure from like third parties on what to put on? Was there any pressure from like a Capcom or a Konami? Hey, we'd love for have to have this as part of the magazines. I know in some magazines that's happened, and I'm just curious if that was ever any pressure, or you really had that kind of control where it was, no, what we say goes, this is what's going in, or this is how much coverage it's going to get.
You know, the only place where when we would go like to CES or later E3 and talk to people about what was coming out. Of course, if we got more information, we could give a preview in Pack Watch or something like that. And also, depending on what kind of very exciting prize they wanted to offer, getting a player's pull contest or a poster, if they had really good artwork, they might be able to score a poster. But in order to get coverage, it just really make a better game.
That's awesome. I love that. And it also, one thing I talk to people about Nintendo Power, there's a very interesting blend of advertising and honesty, because for me, at least growing up reading Nintendo Power for probably a decade, it was always the place where I got like the news of Nintendo. I was a big Nintendo fan. So it was like my Nintendo news source, but never felt like reviews, like an EGM or a GamePro, they would review things. So where was that balance for you in reviews and, again, honesty? Because they were honest and never felt like I was being pandered to or advertised to, even though that is part of it. That's part of the goal, right? How did you achieve that balance? Because I think that's a really tricky balance in this kind of space.
You know, it was tricky. First of all, a game that really sucked wasn't going to get an actual article, right? It would get a video short, and you would actually – again, depending on what year it was, the way that those scores were represented, I think often we had a little meter that combined them, so there were four categories sometimes. But if all of them were low and it sucked, and, you know, over the years, even after I left, sometimes a way of doing it and making it feel more like an individual person's opinion rather than a corporate mouthpiece saying something negative. There was a time when there were a couple of the writers, the editors would each give their comment of what they thought about the game, so they could be a little bit more sharp-tongued. But of course, Nintendo's business partners don't want Nintendo Power to run a video short with ratings that are horrible and then to say crappy things about their game. So it was slightly more of a, if you can't say anything nice, kind of attitude, because if you could say something nice, it was going to get a lot of coverage. There was one time when I really got surprised. I was at like CES, I guess, and someone from Square came up to start talking to me. I was a Japanese person. And, you know, you will put, you know, Final Fantasy on the cover, and he's like talking to me. I'm like, what are you talking about? Like, and I didn't know that, you know, and he was saying all this stuff and about Mr. Arakawa and whatever. And I was just like, completely taken aback. I'm sure I was a complete bitch or dragon lady, whatever you want to say. And, you know, being a haughty American marketing type person. And then I found out that later that so Mr. Arakawa talked to me that he really didn't influence things very much because, like I said, it was all based on the ratings. But with Dragon Warrior and Final Fantasy being the biggest selling franchises in Japan, we were missing out. And he did want to use Nintendo Power as a way of getting the American game player on board with RPGs. So it was true that he wanted. So we did this, I don't know if you remember, we did this series of contests. I think it went on for like 5 months. We would show something about the game, and then there was a contest, and you might get, I can't even remember what the lower level prizes were, but they were, you know, who knows, a t-shirt or something. And at the end, something that I think wasn't even a thing yet, we had a LARPing trip for four to Tortola.
I don't remember this.
And And so the writers, one person went down there and set it up and then came back, and then a couple of them went down there. And one of our writers, who he still works at Nintendo and localization, his name is Dan Osen. He had just gotten married. And he and his wife, it was like their honeymoon. They went and they were, and she played, it couldn't have been Zelda, but there must be some character in Final Fantasy that lays in the forest or something. And so like they leave his new bride laying in the forest, and the kids and their chaperone have to go find Alice laying in the forest.
How fun is that? That's so interesting. I was going to ask you about the contests. The contests were always, they felt extravagant. How did those contests, a lot of those came from Pete, from other companies who were looking for coverage, or you wanted to continue the coverage for these games you liked?
Yeah, it sounds like definitely. It, yeah. And although
there were some wild ones.
They were wild. Like we had a Batmobile. We definitely had things like the Super Bowl or F1 race, or, you know, lots of things like that. Meet a celebrity, Matt Groening finished a poster for someone for Simpsons, like all kinds
That's
of things.
So cool.
But when we asked people what kind of contests they liked, they really would rather win stuff than win trips. And that
interesting.
And it was so experience that they would rather win stuff than an experience. So they really preferred, if they were going to win like a game a month for 2 years, than to win, you know, a trip to Europe. So, that was very funny. But, you know, I was always, you know, thinking big. I wanted, you know, the big moment. And, but the readers, you know, were thinking maybe what was more realistic in their own life and situation.
Yeah. I mean, now I think our trip to Europe would be amazing, but I can see myself as a 12-year-old being like, no, just give me games every month. Why would I want to go to a treasure island? I remember one of them was like a treasure island or something. You had like an you went to an island. That might be the Final Fantasy one you're referring to. That might be the one. I always stuck in my mind, like, I could go to a treasure island. One of my earlier episodes, I went through a lot of old Nintendo Power magazines. I was looking for the grand prize winners. I want to interview someone who won one of the grand prizes. And I did. I interviewed somebody who won the grand prize to see the filming of RoboCop 2. It was this young man who he was sharing his story. He had an amazing time, was very influential. He shared this amazing story of y'all taking care of him. Like, so y'all took care of these people when you did these things. So it was really cool hearing that down by kind of both sides of it, like where these things came from.
Yeah, you know, one that I would love to have been the one to chaperone, but, you know, the writers generally all chaperoned, and was Lucasfilm to give someone a tour. And like the story that I heard anyway, like they got to put on Indiana Jones jacket and all this stuff. They were at Skywalker Ranch, and man,
that's so cool.
I want to go to Skywalker Ranch.
I don't know if I'd be able to fit Indy's jacket, but I sure would try.
Yeah.
That definitely would happen. Oh, that's so cool. I love that.
Six great issues plus six free strategy guides on a hot new game. That's twice the power for still $15. Wow, call now.
So were there any situations in the process of making the magazine where you had maybe features that you were going to do but maybe fell through at the last minute, or any of these? I love hearing stories of oh no, this was almost a disaster, and then how you got through that. Were there any situations like in the process of making the magazine where that you can recall that was like, yeah, we had this feature, or we couldn't get the artwork in time? Because I've talked to other magazine editors that can be sometimes a thing. Yeah, do you have any situations like that where, you know, we had a feature that you were going to run and then all of a sudden, oops, it goes away and you have to scramble, you have to kind of mad scramble?
You know, that doesn't strike me, but probably a famous story that gets told a lot is when we first started, since Tokuma Shoten was our publishing partner, mm-hmm. when we got to Japan and Howard and I went together, I didn't like anything. I thought the colors were off and the craziness. If you look at issue one, like there's some, how much track and field or what, but something with all these like hash mark looks like a cyclone fence in bright pink or something. Anyway, it was crazy. And I was like, absolutely not, just not gonna fit our taste. And it turned into this, we called it the Akasaka Prince Wars. And then the art director quit, and you know, it was, and then Howard called me the Dragon Lady, and now everybody calls me the Dragon Lady. And you know, people were always smoking all the time. And so, and also while we were there, that's when we came up with the Howard and Nestor concept. They were trying to come up with it's hard to get breathing room between all those reviews. So we were coming up with breathing room kind of concepts. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I think that probably was the time where it was the biggest rush to the finish and the biggest disasters was just getting started. And on an ongoing basis, just the feeling of color schemes, et cetera, is quite different from in Japan than from the US. You were mentioning like you thought that you could imagine things feeling more Japanese. So if you go back and look at the first few issues, one area where you can really tell is they would write like comic words, like for emphasis. So it's the words like thwomp or et cetera. Sure. But remember that those words were like often hand-created artwork that was in the film. So for me to say those words don't make sense, like we could only redo so many articles, you know? Sure. And so often one of the things that makes the least sense, and also later in all the comics, mm-hmm. is the use of action words and they're built into the artwork. Even like the Zelda comic, that one was tough because Ishinomori Shotaro is a very famous Japanese artist, and getting him to do this was extremely important. And people in Japan who got him to do it, and then they would send it. And so, you know, when I'm just like, thwing is not a thing. Swinging a sword and, you know, having it say swing. And then they're like, oh, no, we cannot ask him to redo this panel to change that. So that's a good, really good example of one, not just color and design, but it kind of went beyond that.
Sure. I love that. Those large, you did there was a Zelda one and there was a Super Metroid one, I believe. Mm-hmm. I think a Ninja Gaiden 2 had a series like that. That might have been part of the Player's Guide. I don't remember exactly. Those were very ambitious. And y'all had always had interesting ideas. And it's interesting that you say that you had these little breather sections, because in traditional magazines, those would be ads. And y'all never really had ads. Like, I think that's probably why you probably felt led to do that. I'm assuming that's an intentional decision not to have like traditional ads in the magazine, which I always respected. Again, read my friend's GamePro. I'm like, every other page is an ad. You know, here, that just wasn't the case. And I'm
It was intentional at the beginning. At the beginning, what I would say is the amount of people who subscribed, I think our top was 1.3 million from the 3.2. So that was a pretty good conversion rate. So
yeah,
at the beginning, and as you mentioned, we only did six issues. The financial outlay, it was never a break-even proposition, but the financial outlay matched up a little better. And then I think later after in 98 is when I left to work on Pokemon and work in the Treehouse. So after that, we did accept advertising. I've been reminded that I actually was part of that discussion, which I don't remember. But, you know, we financially, it needed to be offset more. But, you know, at the beginning, even part of this conversation is that, you know, if you accept all this advertising, someone can buy the coverage. So that was not meeting the mission.
And I love the fact that that was a very clear mission early on, that you was like, this is going to be, we're going to not only, you know, obviously advertise our games, right? And show the kids the games that are coming out, but provide valuable information. You know, like I learned about the Konami code from Nintendo Power, right? And it was such a vital part of my, again, upbringing and a lot of people's upbringing.
I have to tell you, I have to tell you something about the Konami code. I know I'm not letting you ask all your questions, but.
No, this is fine. Please.
I went into a winery in Walla Walla, Washington. People might not know this, but it's actually a fairly significant wine region. And I'm sitting there and the whole thing is kind of a little like a geek bar. So they've got stuff here, there, and everywhere. And there's like a chalkboard in front of me with up, up, down, down. And I said, you have the Konami code on your thing. And he's looking at me like, okay, this something's up, you know?
Yeah.
And so I had to reveal who I was, but
oh, that's funny. That's funny. You're like, I know what that is. I know exactly what that is.
Right here in my fridge. My husband keeps saying, we can open this one. And I'll be like, no, no, don't open it.
I love it. That's so fun. Did you get all that information from the developers themselves for the codes and such? I know the Counselor's Corner, they were playing the games probably and just learning the games and reporting on the most commonly asked questions. But the Counselor's Corner, I mean, the classified information, was that from the actual developers, like they send you that stuff?
You know, they were supposed to send anything like that that they knew. You know, sometimes it was just that a game is broken, like that you can actually find out later that if you do something, it makes the game do something it wasn't supposed to. But if they were doing it intentionally, Easter eggs, they were supposed to submit those codes to the, it's called lot check, but to the engineering department that, and testing department that made sure that the code was stable. And so, yes, we would get stuff like that. Things that came in-house to Nintendo, the licensees were aware that anyone in Nintendo of America would have access.
Right.
Or, I mean, for a reason. But, sure. Yeah, so they would get that stuff. Imagine when we're talking about Nintendo Power, but if you were in game counseling, they had a system. It was called Elmo. I actually don't know why, but it they had to have a complete written script and a way to jump. And first, keep remembering this is the days when PCs, laptops, everything was before the internet.
Yeah, infancy. Yeah.
They had to be able to find anywhere in a game. If you called a game counselor, they had to be able to find. I mean, it started becoming hundreds of games. And they had to know have written cataloging for these few. There were a few hundred game counselors, and they would have to be able to find information on any title, any place in the game to help people. It's like really amazing, much deeper than what we were doing.
That's so interesting. That's interesting. Again, I can't imagine that the amount of effort that goes into cataloging all that information. How was the culture working at Nintendo during that time? You talked about it a little bit, how you were expecting high-tech futuristic and you didn't quite get that. But how was the culture just working at there, the people that you were surrounded by every day?
Yeah, you know what? Because I started when there was really – the smallest headcount was about 35. Mm-hmm. Yep. So I had the good fortune of having a – actual relationship with the people that were running the company. Other people right. that started after me maybe had a more formal relationship. Mm-hmm. But, you know, so certainly from 83 to 88, 87 or 88, it was, you know, really small, very much just a family. You know, if Mr. Arco was in a meeting with the head of EA or someone and you walked by with a dog, people would parade their dog. He would just leave the meeting to talk to the dog, or he would, when Nintendo worked as a Japanese company, you got big bonus periods. That's what happens in Japan. So people would frequently buy a car after they got their bonus, and he would go drive their cars around the parking lot. There's kind of a famous thing where it was Team Howard Lincoln or Team Mr. Arakawa, and where they drove we made a go-kart track and they did a literal Mario Kart race. And that's you had cool. to say what the whole company got invited out to say what team you were on. Like, he loved having big Christmas parties, and we would, and wasn't for the extravagance. Like, he really mm-hmm. wanted people to feel so connected, and they would do funny things. Like, we have you ever been in a bingo game where at the end, you know, in the end, everyone in the room yells bingo?
I've been in a couple of bingo games, but never where that happens.
Okay, well, there are setups, you know, where okay, we're asking this question, and then everyone yells at the same moment, not realizing. Gotcha. We all got called to go into a warehouse, the whole company, and they explained how everything had been going great and, you know, so thankful, thank you so much, and, you know, blah, blah, blah. Okay, so now for the big surprise. We're going to do a, like, bingo, whatever, everyone say bingo. We're going to have a big surprise, and if you get a bingo, you're going to get an extra 2 months salary or something like this, like big. And then the whole room said bingo at the same time. And that's they just so cool. like it was so cool that the philosophy was so magical that they wanted everyone to have that feeling. And I think another thing that is maybe more on the Japanese side that people maybe miss when you think about Japanese work culture, but every mm-hmm. single person's job is critical to getting the job done. So in terms of kind of looking down on someone or someone being disposable because they have a less impressive job, everyone from the receptionist at the front to the housekeeper to the whatever, that sure. the philosophy was truly that we all, like, it takes every single person to make this work. And I always felt that way, that particularly from the Japanese side, from, you know, we hired a lot of American executive types, and I was not one of the boys out on the golf course. That's true. So I don't want to act like that Fair. Didn't also occur, Sure. but, it was, you know, it really was fun and felt like I really did feel that I was valued.
And that's awesome. And that's a really great feeling. Any company, any situation you're in, it's important to feel valued. And that sounds like sounds like they made intentional efforts in doing so. With our last few minutes, I'd love to just ask you, I shared a little bit how Nintendo Power it was literally like my window to games I knew I'd never play. My family got two games a year, birthday and Christmas, and they were right next to each other. So I'd have two games. I'd get one on December 25th. December 27th, that was the deal, unless I somehow scrounged up some money. So Nintendo Power was always my window into the world of games that that helped me experience those games without actually experiencing them. And it was my inroads to social situations at school when someone was talking about Mega Man. I didn't play Mega Man, but I knew about Mega Man because of Nintendo Power. When you hear stuff like that, how does that make you feel to realize that you were a part, a crucial part of a lot of young people's experiences and growth during that time period? Just from a personal level, like, how does that make you feel?
Yeah, I really love it. It's one of the reasons why I would say that Nintendo Power was the center of my experience at Nintendo. And that's one of the reasons that it was my favorite was it was a whole product. And I have so many people, and I would have that experience as a kid too. When you get something in the mail, like you're so excited to get it. And, you know, it made kids, it wasn't like educational in terms of them being excited mm-hmm. about reading, but the fact that they would enjoy getting this and studying it. And some people, by the way, say whether they didn't get a lot of games because they didn't have a lot of money, whether they, you know, sometimes they say that they were having a crappy time in their childhood or their adolescence, especially.
Sure.
And
sure.
That, you know, it was like comforting and made them feel happy, you know, brought happiness when they would get the magazine. And yeah, it does make me feel great.
You know, it's nothing better, especially as a kid, getting something with your name on it in the mail. Like all the mail was for your parents, but nothing for you that came in with your name on it. It was so cool. It was like so freeing and wonderful. Yeah, it's awesome. So thank you. Thank you for putting all that effort in and doing some good work and really setting an example for, I think, video game magazines to come, because I don't think there's anything quite like Nintendo Power. After Nintendo Power, very quick question before we close. What lessons have you learned from Nintendo Power that you've kind of moved forward to your other work? You said you were involved with Pokemon, and obviously you have a very long storied career. I could go for another hour probably. But what were some of the lessons you learned from Nintendo Power that you were able to adapt into your other work and your future career?
You know, I think certainly the idea that keep your eye on consumer satisfaction. So I think that was very obvious with Pokemon that, you know, fantastic game and franchise, but the idea of making sure that you're doing it well and that you're appealing to the people that love it. So as a product philosophy, I think that where I worked for a company called Enterplay for a while after Nintendo, mm-hmm. and we made yep. a My Little Pony trading card game, a CCG,
okay.
and did a lot of stuff, cons and things. And the My Little Pony brony community, again, was much different. And knowing what sure. folk being focused on them and what they wanted and how they felt about the franchise, I think it matches the philosophy of Nintendo Power.
Thanks once again to Gail for taking time out of her busy schedule to make this 100th numbered episode of The Gamer Looks at 40 that much more special. I meant every word I said. Nintendo Power was huge for me as a kid and holds a special place. So thank you once again. And who knows, maybe we'll chat again on another episode. If you haven't done so already, go to agamerlooksat4040.com for all of my social media links, playlists, and every episode under the sun I've released on the public feed. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a rating or review on your pod player of choice. Many thanks to Kev from the Discord and Pete Harney for their help cutting up the interviews for this Final Fantasy series I'm currently in the middle on and had to put on hold for this interview. I'm sure you can understand why. And thank you for listening to A Gamer Looks at 40 for the last, dang, almost 3 years. Until next time, just be kind to yourselves and each other.